I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, and this is a Studio 2 Extra. What is it like to be inside, say, the Biden campaign 4 years ago, or run John Fetterman's successful bid for U.S. Senate? Brendan McPhillips knows. On top of senior positions in the Obama and Clinton campaigns, he was the senior advisor to the Harris campaign here in Pennsylvania. I wanted to talk to him about that most recent job, a retrospective on his candidate on the Democratic Party, and what strategists like Brendan think about after they lose. He says campaigns are a lot of grueling work, and in a swing state like Pennsylvania, that meant running a massive ground game with thousands of volunteers knocking doors for Kamala Harris. And then it all comes down to a single Tuesday, November 5th.
Election day on any campaign for a campaign manager, win or lose, is a boring yet anxiety-ridden day because you're up before dawn. You're usually sequestered in something that's called a boiler room, which sounds real sexy, but it's just a bland room of some staff that are like waiting to pass reports up the chain on how many people are out on the doors and, you know, what polling places haven't opened yet because somebody slept in and didn't unlock the school. And you just wait there forever. And then when the stuff finally starts coming in, the anxiety picks up a bit. Yeah. And I don't know, like my own emotional state on election day is kind of dead inside at this point because I've just done so many of them. I don't want to allow myself to get too high or too low. The most enjoyable parts of a campaign for me are the interactions with real people, knocking doors, talking to voters on the phone, going to a rally and seeing the way people respond to something that the candidate says, sitting around twiddling our thumbs and waiting for tabulations. Not great.
As a campaign professional, when do you start to draw those conclusions about what went wrong? How do you draw them? Because at some point you have to take the data point that is this election and use it to inform whatever you're going to do 2, 4, 6, 8 years from now.
Mm-hmm. Look, I think staff who are actually working on the campaign are having those conversations among themselves right now.
Sure.
I think there will be a more formalized process at the state level, at the national level, that takes place over the coming weeks and months. It's not a short process. If folks are looking towards MSNBC or CNN to get a real analysis of, you know, what could have been done better, I think you're going to be disappointed. Everybody with the title Democratic strategist on their cryon and is really
because they're being too hasty, is what you're saying. Or they don't have complete data. I mean, what are you missing in the snap analysis?
Yeah, they're being too hasty. Incomplete data is a big one.
Yeah.
And I mean, to be totally honest, I think some people look for their 15 minutes of fame in this moment of time. And
this is when we're all paying attention.
But look, like you can look at vote by mail returns to glean some information off of. You can look at even the like Philadelphia's county website, for example, is being scrutinized a lot to look at the shifts that happened in the city. And you can start to tell a story with that, but you really have to wait months for all the actual individual voter data to settle in the voter file. And then you can actually get a sense of the real demographics of, you know, what populations turned out, who stayed home, who was a regular presidential campaign voter and didn't turn out, who were the sporadic voters that did turn out. And from that, you can actually start putting together the equation of like what trends actually took place rather than people just kind of offering their best guesstimates off of exit polling and, you know, vibes.
Yeah. There's a lot of vibes right now.
Indeed.
So if I were to have a more skeptical analysis of the campaign, what I would point to is the fact that Kamala Harris, although she did okay in the swing states, did consistently run behind Democratic swing state senators, some of whom were incumbents, but some of whom weren't. How do you explain that? Because that would suggest perhaps some weakness in her candidacy.
I mean, I actually think that's kind of common in modern times for more state level localized candidates to outperform the top of the ticket just because of all the brutal negative attacks. Just what's happened to our culture over the last 3 times that Donald Trump has run for president. There's a lot of polarization, a lot of negativity. I mean, you can't watch a Phillies game in Pennsylvania without seeing 27 ads about how somebody's going to break into your house and murder your family, and it's all Kamala Harris's fault.
Yeah, it's incredibly dark.
Yeah, it's really dark. And a lot of those senators have been known figures in their states for a long time. They're more familiar to people. So I actually don't...
More familiar than Kamala Harris.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Bob Casey, for example, he's in a tight one right now. They're, you know, going through counting all those votes. But Bob Casey's a household name in Pennsylvania. Sure. People love him. He outperformed President Biden. He's outperformed the top of the ticket in many of his contests. And I'm not an expert on all the other battleground states, but I think that's a phenomenon that if you looked at, you would see repeating itself elsewhere.
I'm so curious what you're taking away from this election in terms of the impact of a ground game. Because I'll say personally, just as a citizen of Philadelphia, I have never felt the ground game more. It was door knocks. It was calls. It was impressive and it was relentless. Mm. And yet here in Philadelphia, the turnout was modest. Now, of course, not all the votes have been counted, so that might be a little bit hasty, that analysis. But I'm curious how you evaluate the impact of the ground game here in Pennsylvania in this election, given that, giving you credit, I thought it was the most extensive I'd ever seen.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, it was a really impressive ground game, and I just want to give a huge shout out to all the people on the staff and the thousands of volunteers that built that, because it's really hard work and it takes months upon months to put it together. It's not something that you can just buy when a billionaire decides to, you know, endorse your campaign.
No specific billionaire we're talking about there, of course.
Of course not. I think a lot of people, even people who work in field organizing, are asking themselves that question about, does organizing really matter when you throw all this effort into it and you still come up short? I am presently of the belief that it absolutely still does.
Yeah.
I think this is, just to be honest, this is one of the bigger questions that we absolutely do need to wait for the voter-specific data to come back on, so that we can see who showed up, who was sporadic. Did we actually talk to that exact individual? How many times did we talk to them?
But the big question for me, I guess, is when it comes to these national elections, is there so much attention now? Is there so much kind of free media that people know what's going on and that actually contacting them and that face-to-face level doesn't move the needle as much as it does for a Senate race, a congressional race, a state Senate race, because it does feel like politics is all consuming now. And that might, in some ways, I guess, neutralize the impact of ground game if people kind of already know what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that our media landscape, both in terms of earned media, the crushing amount of paid media that we all have to digest, in my eyes, it makes the ground game even more important.
Oh, interesting.
I think one of the biggest problems facing our country and like society in general, not just the United States, but the way that people are so siloed in the information that they allow themselves to receive, you know, nose down in our smartphones, iPads, laptops all day long. And good field organizing is building an actual community. It's talking to neighbors, having pizza parties in your office. The Nevada team, for example, did a really cool use of their offices where they invited people in to, you know, talk about how to access affordable housing, and other states started riffing off of that and using the brick and mortar offices as spaces, not just to campaign, but to connect people to resources, to address, you know, the actual issues that people are facing in their communities and build a relationship and a dialogue back and forth so that then you could also talk
like
about
a service conversation hub instead of just a place to give out yard signs or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that is the what organizing is all about. It's kind of going back to its roots. And I think the future of field organizing needs to lean way more into that. And we need to actually be more focused on how we create genuine in-person connection with one another at a time when I think people are longing for it. Yeah. You know, I ran Pennsylvania in 2020 for President Biden in the middle of the pandemic. And when we finally started doing in-person work, I mean, you could feel the palpable energy that people had, just so excited to be back together in person.
Yeah.
And if you talk to any field person, I think one of the reasons why they do this work is because they take a certain amount of pride in being able to build that and provide that
So zooming out from this election and then just looking at the Democratic Party and its message, the one thing I constantly wonder is whether the Democrats just need a simpler message. Not so much that they need to change what their goals are, but Trump, for all of his flaws, is very direct. And sometimes I wonder, do Democrats need to be more direct in their messaging?
I absolutely think that we should spend time as a party really thinking about how we message in addition to what the message is or should be.
Because I think people like the message policy-wise. When you strip away the candidates' names, they'll tell you they like Democratic policies. Yeah. And then they don't vote for Democrats.
And this is one of the most frustrating things for me that occurs anytime the Democratic Party loses an election and there's this call to like move further to the right. And I just want to tell people, like, wait a minute, take the party away, take the candidate away, and actually ask people their stances on the issues, and issue by issue, with very few exceptions, the Democratic Party is the home for where people are policy wise. But you're totally right. Democrats need to be better about how we talk about this. We've got tons of 17-point plans, and we always, I think, need to be more thoughtful about how we actually communicate our values, how we bring people in to share them, rather than just explaining everything to death. And I don't necessarily think that, like, to be clear, I'm not criticizing the Harris campaign. It would not be fair for me to do that. I loved a lot of the ads that we ran. I thought they did communicate values really well. But we should always open our minds and ask, like, can we be better? I think it's, you know, when you look across the world and you see Western civilizations everywhere shifting to the right in these economic circumstances of, you know, post-pandemic inflation and rising prices, it's not fair to say, oh, well, the Harris campaign screwed this one up. These are global forces at play. I think sometimes people want to be too simplistic and just Monday morning quarterbacking this and, you know, blaming the candidate herself, which I think is so unfair. I mean, imagine
thrown into this the last
107 days of a campaign that normally lasts almost 2 years, and she did a phenomenal job.
And maybe it's less about simplicity of message and more about the fact that I think Democratic candidates sometimes writ large come off as too careful, too scripted, too politician-y, for lack of a better word. And that there is a way to bust through that. We have seen some Democrats do that, by the way. Mm-hmm. Just to get people to believe that this person sees me, cares about me, is like me.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think sometimes that comes down to the messenger. I think sometimes it comes down to just really ingrained ways in which Democrats have spoken about issues for too long. And I think we should always be looking to figure out how we can improve that, how we can flip the script on some of this stuff.
It could come down to candidate recruitment too. There's a lot of lawyers who run for political office as Democrats, and Republicans usually pick, it seems like, business people. Not saying that's a better model, but is there a way to get real people into politics on the Democratic side? No, there are some for sure, but get more of them in there so that they can make those connections, those visceral connections with voters.
Yeah, I think we have to recruit really well. We need campaign finance reform. Yeah. And it seems so quaint to even talk about that as we're like on our way into a more authoritarian right-wing administration and a right-wing court. Like, we're not going to get those things for a long time, if ever.
But that would help real people run.
It would help real people run. But that said, like, look around the state and the country, and you see a lot of great examples of people that are figuring this out and doing it. Here in Philadelphia, we've got, some great state reps who are real people that, you know, left their prior career and ran for office. I'm thinking of a former reporter, for instance, Liz Fiedler in South Philly.
Can confirm she's not a lawyer. She used to work here.
Right, exactly. Malcolm Kenyatta is a great star, up-and-coming star in the party. Yeah. And over across Commonwealth in Allegheny County, Sarah Inamorato, county executive. And, you know, I could go on and on. There's a lot of really great examples of this. But, yeah, we need to encourage and build power among working people to give them the support to run for office and take leadership roles in the party. And we don't need to wait for somebody to come and save us with campaign finance reform to do it. We need to ourselves open up our pocketbook and donate to those campaigns and candidates. We need to pressure the institutional class of donors to be more creative in the candidates that they fund and who they get behind. It takes a lot of work, but we can figure it out.
The question I would have for both major parties is, can you build a coalition that consistently gets you above, let's say, 52-53% of a national vote in a presidential election? Because right now, I think we're stuck in 52-48, 48-52 land. And we make big proclamations about what are ultimately very small swings among a very small group of voters. It doesn't seem like either party has found that roadmap to get us out of that bubble.
I honestly don't know.
Yeah.
That's a tough reality about where we are as a country right now. You know, that's not caused by candidates. It's not caused necessarily by the policy positions that they stake out. We have a lot of really broken institutions in this country that need to be completely reformed or broken down and reassembled. I mean, the way that we consume media in this country is poisoning to people's brains. I mean, I remember being a little kid growing up, listening to my parents and grandparents telling me that if I watched too much TV, it was going to rot my brain.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out it actually rotted their generation's brain. You know, Fox News, all the even further to the right news outlets and just extreme like propaganda mills that have just found their way into people and latched on. And I don't know how we break that. But I don't think we should give up on it. We need to figure it out. And that's one of the reasons why I'm such a believer in actually like touching grass, as the kids say, and getting out and knocking on a door and having a face-to-face conversation with someone so that you can begin to like peel away those caricatures that we draw of one another. It requires a new generation of leadership to step up and say, hey, we got to fix this shit.
Yeah, because otherwise you are just going candidate to candidate.
Exactly.
If the candidate on one side is a demagogue, it doesn't matter. They're coming in with 45% locked in.
Yep, that's right.
That's a hard place for a democracy to survive.
Yeah, it's we're kind of like two tectonic plates that are just rubbing against each other for too long and, you know, may have just experienced the earthquake.
That was Brendan McPhillips, a veteran of five Democratic presidential campaigns, most recently serving as a senior advisor to the Harris campaign here in Pennsylvania. Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Diana Martinez engineered this podcast episode. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, and thanks for joining me.